Good afternoon and welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. I am Dr. Mark Peacher, Associate Dean of Faculty and Deloitte Professor of Accountancy at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chat series is made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte is the brand under which tens of thousands of dedicated professionals and independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to select clients. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. The virtual museum and archive is the preeminent source for original and primary material on the regulation of the capital markets. Today's broadcast is the 12th in a series that began in 2009 to address current issues in financial regulation of interest to the accounting and auditing professions. The Deloitte Fireside Chats are now the longest continuous running program series in the museum. All past broadcasts, ranging from disclosure effectiveness to the role of professional judgment, are available in the Deloitte Fireside Chats section under programs in the virtual museum and archive. I had the privilege of moderating three previous chats in 2011 on the role of the auditor, 2012 on the profession's look at the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and on 2014 on financial reporting. I'm happy to share that more than 65,000 visitors to the virtual museum and archive have accessed one or more of these chats during or since the broadcast. And I encourage those joining us today to check out the Deloitte Fireside Chat section at the conclusion of the broadcast. I think the series will be well worth your time. Today's program, we'll look at financial reporting of non-GAAP measures. I'm joined today by Christine Devine, Brian Lane, and Joe Lukumnik. Christine is a partner with Deloitte & Touche, LLP, in its national office in Washington, D.C., and serves as National Director of SEC Services for Deloitte & Touche, LLP. She previously worked as Associate Chief Accountant in the Office of the Chief Accountant for the SEC's Division of Corporate Finance. Brian is a partner with Gibson Dunn Crutcher in LLP in Washington and previously served as director of the SEC's Division of Corporate Finance from 1996 to 1999. John is managing partner of Sinclair Capital, LLC in New York, and served as deputy comptroller for the city of New York in the 1990s. He is author of the recently released What They Do With Your Money, How the Financial System Fails Us and How to Fix It. So let's begin our discussion by turning to Christine, and let's just start the conversation by explaining what is considered to be a non-GAAP measure versus a metric or a key performance indicator. And maybe in the course of that, can you describe for us what are some commonly used non-GAAP measures?
Sure, happy to do that. Thanks, Mark, for that introduction. When I describe a non-GAAP measure, I think of it as a measure of performance that's different than what's presented in the income statement. So that would be an example that's a derivation of income. So it could be adjusted net income, adjusted earnings per share, core earnings, some type of adjusted operating income. And you would adjust it for perhaps things like restructuring charges or impairments or what companies consider to be non-recurring. You can also have a non-GAAP measure that's a measure of liquidity, and then it would be something that's based off of the statement of cash flow. So an example of that would be free cash flow. That is operating cash flow less capital expenditures. And so the technical definition is it excludes or includes amounts that are included in the most directly comparable GAAP amount, and whether that's from the income statement or the statement of cash flow or the balance sheet, as those examples that I walked through help to illustrate. So you're taking these commonly understood gap amounts, this income or this cash flow, and you're removing a component of that amount, and that component would typically be required to be included under gap. And you can always articulate the components and quantify those components and explain what their impact is. It's just when you do the math, as we call it, you do the math and you say adjusted income or adjusted cash flow, that's when it becomes a non-GAAP measure. And it is important to actually identify what non-GAAP measures a company uses, because then they're subject to this disclosure framework and the SEC's rules and regulations. And there is some subtle non-GAAP measures. So when I work with companies on non-GAAP measures, sometimes I'll say, gee, you didn't define this measure as a non-GAAP measure, and maybe it's something subtle like net debt. But net debt would be a non-GAAP measure because that's borrowings less cash, which again is not a GAAP recognized number. And so you want to make sure as a registrant that you've identified your whole population of non-GAAP measures that you used. Now, contrast that, Mark, you asked, what about a key performance metric, and what are those, and how are they envisioned in the rules? And some key performance metrics are not part of the non-GAAP rules. They're scoped out, although they have a similar framework, and the SEC expects clear disclosure around them in that sense, and you'd want them to be transparent and defined and described. And so those would be examples of those would be unit sales, or number of employees, or number of subscribers, or occupancy rate, or number of likes is a big one in the technology type space. And they could be a measure, a statistical measure that illustrates your size or your growth. And they may not be included in the financial statements. So these numbers may not be derived from the financial statement amounts. Like I said, the number of likes isn't necessarily translate back into your financial statements. And so those are just a brief description of some of the differences.
I think that's very helpful. And I particularly liked, no pun intended, the comment about likes. And I thought about, you know, there's tweets. This technology
is really
changing the world. When you think about non-GAAP measures, are these things primarily substitutes for GAAP measures, or are they complements to GAAP measures?
Yep. They are supposed to be supplements. They're not supposed to supplant. They're not supposed to replace the GAAP measures. And a lot of the focus right now by the SEC really is on prominence, which is a connected issue to that, and that they are not supposed to be more prominent than the GAAP measure, and that runs to the replacing versus supplement.
All right. That's helpful, and we'll talk a little bit more maybe about prominence in a while. But I want to pivot to John, and I guess a basic question is, why do companies, given they have so many GAAP measures to deal with already, why do they use non-GAAP measures?
Well, first off, I want to thank you and the SEC Historical Society and Deloitte for inviting me. I think it's nice that you guys have an investor here, because in theory, at least, all this is for our benefit, something that issuers sometimes, they know, but in the rush to prepare financials, lose sight of as they're doing all the compliance work. And so investors have a love-hate relationship with non-GAAP measures. We like them because they tell us more about the way the company is actually being run. There's sort of a kabuki dance that goes on every quarter, and a large kabuki dance that goes on every year as companies close the books and try to put things into GAAP format. There are very few companies that actually run their companies according to generally accepted accounting principles. They run it for operating efficiencies and for operating metrics. And investors want to understand how the companies run. And so to the extent that companies give us more information about the metrics that they actually care about, that gives us good information. How is the company being run? What do they care about? Often these non-GAAP metrics are embedded in their executive compensation plans. And so to us, they are more relevant information in some ways, or as Christine said, they complement the relevant information from GAAP measures with relevant information about what the company itself thinks is important. Obviously, they can be misused. I'm sure we'll get into misleading GAAP disclosures. But in the best of all possible worlds, they provide additional relevant information. Investors are also very concerned with what the future will be. Accounting is ex post transactionally based. When you exclude non-recurring one-time charges or one-time expenses, you sort of get a better idea of what the baseline is. And so it's useful to understand, again, what the actual state of the company is and what it's likely to be going forward. And finally, the KPIs that Christine said, and sustainability metrics and other things that aren't non-GAAP financial measures but are technically non-GAAP, just provide a broader set of information for investors to look at. So that's all the reasons we like it. The reasons we hate it are obvious. They can be misused. And the more tools you have at your disposal, the more creative you can be in misusing them. When, for instance, someone excludes non-recurring expenses but includes non-recurring revenues, it makes the company look much better than it is, and it gives a false sense of baseline. And that is a problem. And so the need, as Christine said, to reconcile and explain what's going on is very important for investors, because in the end, the GAAP measures become the touchstone against which we can say, yes, these non-GAAP measures are being used in a rational and informative way instead of an irrational and misleading way.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And it is good to have an investor perspective. And in some ways, that could have been the question. But Brian, do you have anything to add in this particular area, adding a little more color about why companies choose to use non-GAAP measures?
Sure. I think that companies want to use them because they believe that, like John says, that it sets forth a baseline. In their lingo, it would be the core operations, right? That in essence, they're saying, when you measure our performance from quarter to quarter or year to year, you should not hold against us sort of one-time losses or credit us with one-time gains or special items. So we sold a business. We made a lot of money on it. It'll go into other income or, you know, wherever it shows up, but don't think you should expect that every year, right? You know, isn't that really the purpose of MD&A, which is to look and say, please describe to investors why the financial statements shouldn't just be read at their face value. Help understand what you might expect in the future. So they could likewise sell a business and lose money and have a $200 million loss. Does that mean that selling widgets, you know, that it's not as profitable as it was the year before? And they would say, no, you should exclude that in looking at what our results were. They also like to adjust for non-cash items, depreciation, amortization, that sort of thing, because it's not coming out of their pocket. You know, GAAP recognizes there are true costs. Your equipment ages, and it will have to be replaced, so amortization is a totally appropriate thing to take into account. But if you look at what banks do, for example, they lend off of EBITDA, you know, earnings before tax, depreciation, interest, amortization, and this is how you do any small business in the world today. If they go on to borrow money from a bank, they're going to show their cash flow numbers. They're going to show their EBITDA. The banks don't even really ask for what your net income is under GAAP. It's not important to them because that's what you're measured. So if you're a company and you're having to give those numbers to the bank, why wouldn't you give those numbers to investors as well? So that's, I think, what the company take is on non-GAAP measures.
Yeah, it's very helpful. I like coming to do these talks in part because I always learn, and you investors care about what banks care about. That makes a lot of sense. Well, given that there's really good ways to use non-GAAP measures and that it can really help users of financial statements better understand what you said, Brian, core operations are more persistent, but there's also an ability to abuse these, there must be a set of regulations that the SEC or other parties may have out there for companies to follow. So, Christine, what are some of these key regulations and interpretations that govern non-GAAP measures Maybe you can highlight those and highlight some of the most significant disclosure requirements for companies that use non-GAAP financial measures.
Sure, thanks, Mark. And Brian, keep me honest, because Brian's the one attorney in the room here who knows the rules much better than I do. And I will say I'm going to be very brief because I know you have a lot of more interesting questions to go through than me just talking about what the rules are. And I also want to give a shameless plug for our non-GAAP measure roadmap that Deloitte put out that's about 80 pages long that goes through excruciating detail about all these rules and SEC comment letter focus and disclosure controls and procedures. So everything you ever wanted to know is in that book. It is on Deloitte.com, so feel free to access that. So I'll give my very brief description of the rules so you can understand what the framework is. In 2003, pursuant to SOX, the SEC issued the non-GAAP measure rules, and Reg G is the rule you most often and frequently hear about, and that regulates and covers your oral statements and all statements that you make that have non-GAAP measures in there. And when you use a non-GAAP measure under Reg G, it can't be misleading. So that's the overarching most important rule, as I think about it, is, again, it cannot be misleading. And you have to present the comparable GAAP measure and reconcile it to it. So then after Reg G, for your filed documents and for disclosures in your furnished document, you have item 10 of Regulation SK. That was also part of the same 2003 rules. And for your furnished documents and your filed documents, it has to be equal or greater prominence, and you have to disclose the purpose and usage. And so again, that's press releases that are furnished and filed documents. Then on top of that, for filed documents, you have additional prohibitions that exist. Prohibitions on the use of certain adjustments for a liquidity measure and prohibitions that exist for certain adjustments for a performance measure. After that, it's also in 2003, the SEC issued about 33 FAQs. Those are frequently asked questions that interpreted the rules. And then about 7 years later, they replaced those with what we call compliance and disclosure interpretations. And then that brings us to present day, the next significant rule slash guidance interpretation that came out was updated compliance and disclosure interpretations in May of 2016. And those really dealt with better guidance defining and describing what measures are considered to be misleading, and then a lot of really good information on prominence, and gave some examples that were pretty thorough about what was considered too prominent in the non-GAAP space versus GAAP. Brian, did I leave much out there?
I think that's a good summary. I don't think anybody wants to go rule by rule, yeah. And you certainly can in the Deloitte books one place, but I think that's a good flyby.
All right. John, any investor perspective to add to that or no?
Well, let me take the flip side of this, which I know you were going to get to later, Mark, which is, you know, how can you get into problems and how can they be misleading? Because that's the flip side of Christine's how not to be misleading, right? And sometimes it's not even intended to be misleading. It's just misleading to investors who may read, for instance, the same term, you know, like free cash flow, in different earnings releases, and not understand that the two companies actually mean something totally different. And so the real question is how not to be misleading, which, as Christine and Brian said, is the overarching mandate. All the rest is commentary, right? That's the overarching mandate. And I would add, from an investor point of view, it's not only don't be misleading, it's be informative. So there are a couple of things. First, consistency. You probably ought to calculate these things the same way from period to period. And if you don't, you ought to highlight and explain what the change is and why you made it. The second is that the audit committee, the board, the audit committee has, in my mind, some obligations around how these non-GAAP measures are disclosed. Disclosure control procedures should exist for public companies in terms of what they see. Many audit committees ask their external auditors, for instance, to give a read, and I use that word deliberately, we'll get into what that means, of their earnings releases, for instance. How careful a read that is often varies by what the agreement is between the audit committee and the external auditor. But I think audit committees have a role here to understand why management is using non-GAAP measures, why the specific non-GAAP measures were chosen, how they're being calculated, and to make sure there are controls around their way they're being calculated and disclosed. So that's one aspect here. I think the other interesting aspect of why things are confusing is a policy question. And it's perhaps broader than we're going to go into, but you know, GAAP by definition is an accounting standard promulgated by FASB. And for whatever reason, there are things FASB could have spent the last 8 years defining that it has chosen not to. It could have defined a way to calculate EBITDA. It has chosen not to. And it could have tried to define some sustainability metrics. There's now a not-for-profit private sector entity called SASB, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, that's tried to define that on an industry-by-industry basis. FFO, free funds from operation, is a standardized accounting term now, but it's not promulgated by FASB. It's promulgated by the real estate industry. And so I do think there's a policy vacuum here that could... you're never going to not have non-GAAP measures because the world changes technology, as Christine said, as an example. But there are some very frequently used non-GAAP measures that you would think that FASB could undertake a project and get their arms around and minimize the amount of confusion that's out there.
Yeah, it's very helpful. There's this proliferation of non-GAAP measures, and you've given some really good reasons why they exist. The investors are demanding it. Creditors will demand it. So they're very useful. And we've seen recent regulatory action in May of 2016, as Christine said. But Brian, what I hope that you might be able to do for us is to give us a little historical context about when did non-GAAP measures sort of launch into being a very popular way to better communicate, or in some cases maybe paper over some performance that's not as strong as one would like.
Sure. Look, some measures like EBITDA have been around forever, but I think that if we get to what the adjusted income numbers and that sort of thing, in my view, that really came into prominence in the 1990s while I was the director in Corp Fin. And I think it was largely... I was there, but I had no control for lots of reasons. But it was really the internet bubble, I think, that fueled it, because the internet bubble created a phenomena where people were questioning whether accounting was the right way to measure performance. People were suggesting that the number of eyeballs on a website and visits and such were more important than revenue numbers, or that revenue numbers were more important than earnings numbers, because a lot of the internet companies in the 90s were not making money, although their stock was doubling and tripling with regularity. The other phenomena that developed in the 90s and was the other problem, you know, there were three contributing factors to, what came out of that. So you had non-GAAP measures, which I'll go back to in a second. You had whispered earnings, okay, that were helping companies meet analyst estimates, and that gave rise to Regulation FD. And then you had earnings management, because companies were punished heavily for missing their earnings estimates by a penny, all right? And so if you're in a world where you're punished for meeting your estimates by a penny, what are you going to do as management? All right? You're going to either whisper to the analysts so that they'll lower their numbers so that you meet them and everybody's happy, or you create a non-GAAP measure to say, this is how you should measure whether we met the quarter's performance or the year's performance. And that really gave birth to the non-GAAP metric. And so a lot of internet companies were not profitable, as they said, but if they adjusted for some, knocked out some of their expenses, you know, there was one of the hot topics of the time was expensing stock options, for example, in the technology space. That's huge. That was a huge issue when I was there. And, you know, they had APB 20 at the time, which you didn't really have to expense except in extraordinary circumstances. But, you know, ultimately, you had to expense those options. There were a lot of companies that felt that was not appropriate, that, that you run that through their income statement. It's not really costing me anything, and yet my earnings are, you know, in the dumps because of that, so don't hold that against me. So they would adjust for that sort of thing, but they would also adjust for impairments or you know, they bought a company, and tech companies were buying companies all the time, and then they found out they were not all that were advertised, and they turned out to be dogs, and they impaired the whole amount, and you know, that can really screw up an income statement, right? You know, on what your core business is. But there were some excesses that went on, and that's why it came into Sarbanes-Oxley in 2002, is that companies were basically taking out regular items that were misleading them as one-time, like calling an impairment a one-time event. It was the most popular thing. They took big bath accounting hits. Remember those? Oh, yeah. You know, in the 90s, where it's like, let's roll everything in the kitchen sink and take a giant accrual, you know, and then they say these are one-time things, so the stock would go up when they take these big bath accounting. These are things we observed inside the commission. Christine remembers. We're like, this defies logic. You take this huge write-off, the stock goes up, and then you use non-GAAP measures to say, this was all a one-time thing, and then your numbers look really great. And then, of course, the earnings management, you can reverse that accrual and, right, and bleed it into the income statement. So all kinds of problems developed in the 90s, and they really showed up when the bubble burst in 2000. And then when WorldCom and Enron came along in 2002 and collapsed, it got the regulators' attention, and they went to the SEC and said, okay, what's the problem here? And non-GAAP was one of those identified. I also told you about selective disclosure. I already told you about earnings management. We were already taking enforcement cases on earnings management in the 90s before I left in 2000. So I think that's what gave rise to the non-GAAP. I have since then, I'll just give kind of the postscript on why it's become interesting now. Right. So it became, you know, I think that Christine mentioned the FAQs that came out about 2006 and such, and they were pretty harsh going into everything that John listed. Say why you use them, why they're important for investors, what do they show you that GAAP doesn't show you. And what it did was it led to a lot of boilerplate disclosure that companies put into their, you know, reconciliation section. Was it useful? I think initially, yes. Question about whether they are. And so the SEC pulled those FAQs about 2010 because everybody was using non-GAAP measures. Everybody had their, I won't say it's boilerplate, that it criticizes the work of us lawyers and accountants and that sort of thing, but let's just say it wasn't dynamic disclosure.
Certainly not particularized to an individual company.
That's right, but you know, but it was true every quarter. So if that's true every quarter and you keep the same disclosures, is it really boilerplate, or is it just each quarter you look at it and say, yeah, it's still true? But anyway, what happened is not many comments were issued by the SEC. By 2010, by certainly 2012, the number of comment letters that came from the SEC on non-GAAP were very small. And so what changed? Well, in about 2015, 2016, some academic studies come along to say, look at these statistics about people using non-GAAP numbers. And Mark, I'll defer to you to go into some of the details of what the academic studies said. But then there are firms like Audit Analytics and such that start publishing studies like 85% of the people are using GAAP. But the thing that got them is, or non-GAAP, I should say, that the vast majority of the non-GAAP measures enhance the performance rather than detract from performance. And so it became a writing of suspicion. Like, are people using non-GAAP measures only because they make things look better than the GAAP numbers? And so that drew scrutiny back, put some political overlay now in Congress, putting pressure on the SEC chair about what are you going to do about it? You see these studies, what are you going to do? And the SEC comes out with its new guidance in May of 2016 that cracks down again back to where they were in 2006. But there are no rules in this area. It's just an interpretation. Like in the May interpretation, they say you must lead with the GAAP number. and then you can have the non-GAAP number. That was never the rule before. They said equal prominence, and SEC was always fine with leading with the non-GAAP number as long as the GAAP number accompanied it, you know? So they really did change the rules through this interpretation, but that's the crackdown. So I'll stop there. Mark, if you want to add anything on the academic studies.
No, I think it is very interesting and it's somewhat rewarding to hear, you know, the interplay between academic research and not necessarily rule making, but new interpretations. Christine, I want to maybe pivot to you, seeing that you've been taking down some notes. I don't know. The couple of things, there's a big difference in the way that it was, things that led to the initial launch of non-GAAP performance measures in the 1990s and leading up to the late 1990s and early 2000s with the bubble. Brian's given us some good context about what happened recently. It seemed like you were almost saying while the cat's away, the mice will play. There was a slow rise in non-GAAP measures, and then some attention was brought to that, and there's these new interpretations. So, Christine, I don't know if you have something to add about either popular measures that are sometimes presented in different ways with either free cash flow, if you have a slightly different perspective about why we're seeing so much attention given to non-GAAP performance measures today, or not?
Sure, I'll add a couple thoughts. Certainly, as Brian described, there's now been a proliferation of non-GAAP measures, and the other issue that some of these studies has focused on is the disparity between the GAAP number and the non-GAAP number has increased dramatically. So you can take a significant loss and turn it into a very significant income. And again, there's lots of numbers that are flown around by what that differential is. And so I think that's certainly another factor that you see. And prominence has become more of an issue. And so for all those reasons, the SEC certainly has focused on it. As far as the titling issue, you mentioned where you could have a measure called free cash flow that could be defined dramatically different by two different companies. You definitely see that. And that gets just back to the transparency issue. And it's important to define what your non-GAAP measure is, if it's free cash flow, and how it's calculated. And the SEC has guidance that says it can't be confusingly similar to a GAAP title, and it needs to be descriptive of what it is. So if you have free cash flow and it's anything other than operating cash flow less CapEx, consider calling it adjusted free cash flow. If you got five other things that are being adjusted, the same thing, don't call it EBITDA if it takes out restructuring charges and impairments and other types of charges. It would be adjusted EBITDA. So I do think it's important to get the title correct. And then measures like operating income, which are GAAP, you shouldn't call a non-GAAP measure operating income since that's a GAAP accepted term. You would call it adjusted operating income or segment income or something to that effect.
Yeah, so one version of non-GAAP performance measures is that you can simultaneously have your cake and eat it too. You can have a big bath for GAAP purposes, but then you can use a non-GAAP measure to say that big, pay no attention to this big bath. But what I'm really wondering, Brian, is can you describe any particular non-GAAP measures that actually may have implications for the company's ability to generate longer-term value? Do some measure? Are there conditions under which non-GAAP measures are really helpful for investors, even sophisticated investors?
Yes, I think so. I think what we're seeing really today is currency fluctuations is one. You know, the ruble collapsed, the euro really adjusted significantly, as are other currencies. And so it's quite common for all my global companies to give a constant currency measure. The SEC staff has never given one of my clients a hard time on a constant currency measure because they find that it is helpful. And it does give you an idea into what the core sales are if there weren't currency currency fluctuations, and you can calculate what the exact impact of currency is. And so I'm thinking that John and other investors would find that particularly useful. Is that for short term? Is that for long term? I think it's for both, but I think non-GAAP measures are probably, if I'm speaking fairly, more short term, because I think Wall Street has become such a short term world that an impairment that happens in one quarter or a restructuring charge or something like that, they basically want to say, don't hold this against us. And in whatever modeling you do, you know, take that into account. And usually, you know, the investors are wise enough to do it. I think what they really fear, they don't fear the investors, they fear the press. Mm. Because the press, if they just saw what the GAAP number was, you know, big name company loses, has a loss for the quarter, you know, or something like that. And people are like, I'm selling my stock, you know, sort of thing.
So ultimately they fear the investors. The press is just the
Well, that's right. That an investor, you're right. Ultimately the investor reads the headline from a journalist who doesn't really understand, you know, what was behind the loss. And so by having the non-GAAP measure, and this is why a lot of companies, I think, and some of them did it for the wrong reasons, but I think some companies put in their headlines, you know, the little bullets they had in the head, record EBITDA growth, but net loss on the quarter, that they wanted the journalists to basically see, all right, maybe it was a mixed quarter, or it wasn't like head for the exits, you know, type of thing, which, let's face it, some investors do that. They read a story and they think, if I'm the fastest one out the door, you know, I'm not going to lose as much or something, and that's a bad investment philosophy, not what institutions do. But hopefully that's helpful
that's very helpful.
Trying to say whether it's long-term, short-term.
To what you were saying, Brian, and how John jumped in there about ultimately it's the investor, because even the sophisticates have to think about how will the unsophisticated investor respond to these headlines.
Sometimes it's the very sophisticated investor response. I mean, we talk about investors A as if they're monolithic, and B as if it's, you know, 1992. There are a lot of algorithmic traders now, which have machine language reading that read those headlines and trade off of it. So, even if it's a temporary, you know, 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute drop, it can add to the volatility in that security. So I agree with Brian that that's one reason the headlines are written that way. It's. I'm not saying that's a good thing. In fact, I think it's a bad thing. It's just reality today. So, you know, I think no one would consider machine language, algorithmic traders, non-sophisticated, but they do react to that stuff very quickly, and that is a problem. I think to your other question about, I'm not going to call it long-term, but future insight. It often depends when you dig into it, if you're sort of a forensic type of investor. There are certain situations in which the non-GAAP measures are helpful. So and sometimes they're the opposite of what the company intends. So when people adjust out reserves for legal or environmental or whatever, and there are specialty investment research houses that will make a judgment about the adequacy or inadequacy of those reserves, you can, as Brian said, they may get reversed in the future. So in effect, you have a pool of non-disclosed or non-GAAP disclosed revenues that one can think about in the future. And then there are specific situations. So, for instance, in IPOs, you often get non-GAAP. You get pro forma statements of what would happen after the use of proceeds from the IPO, and that gives you a very good idea of what would happen to debt loads, to marketing, whatever. So, again, you know, non-GAAP measures have a valid place in the world, and smart investors do take advantage of them, sometimes in ways that issuers intend and sometimes in ways issuers don't intend.
That was a really insightful point about the new version of the sophisticated investor being, you know, speed trading, and even though it may not have longer-term implications for the fundamental value of a company, there's still an arbitrage. There's still a chance there, even if it's, like you said, hours or even minutes.
Or milliseconds, actually.
Milliseconds, exactly right.
So I want to shift gears a little bit, and maybe I'm going to talk a little bit about what, as Christine pointed out earlier, is really a key performance indicator that might not even qualify today as a non-GAAP measure. There are some users, investors and other users, who have been pushing for more integration of environmental, social, and governance measures into financial reports. And I'm not really just talking about a separate report that tells you about these things. I'm talking about integrating it into financial reports. So let me, John, you're a little bit on a roll, so I'll keep with you for a second and maybe pivot after you've given some thoughts. But what do you see today, and what do you think the future holds with regard to the integration of, you know, ESG, environmental, social, and governance measures into financial performance as a non-GAAP measure?
Okay. Let me plead guilty as charged to being some of those investors who think we should have more of these reports. Let me just give you a state of the world as I see it today, and then tell you what I think of the future. So Brian went back to the 90s of the tech bubble. I'll go back to the 70s and South Africa, where investors realized that their investments could have broad social impact and could be affected by broad social and environmental trends. But it was very much a stakeholder type disclosure. So the type of reports that you're talking about that companies do, sustainability reports, are not necessarily solely geared towards investors. They are geared towards stakeholders, which could be investors certainly, but NGOs, suppliers often read these sort of things, customers, the press, regulators. And there's some really good information in them. And the first set of disclosure regimes were designed around that sort of stakeholder theory, the Global Reporting Initiative, for instance. And it's done a really good job. But they're not geared for the type of disclosures we're talking about, which are aimed at investors and financial materiality only. They may contain financial materiality, but they're broader than that. Which brings us sort of to current date. There is an increasing belief by three-quarters of all investors, as judged by the CFA Society survey, that environmental, social, and governance factors have impact on financial bottom lines of companies. And so the question is, that's nice, but we don't have any standard metrics to use. There are three initiatives, I take it back, going on right now that I think within the next 5 years will have impact on what sort of metrics get disclosed. The first is there is something called the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, or SASB. This, as I mentioned before, is a private sector, not-for-profit initiative. It has gone through on a sector-by-sector basis, industry-by-industry, and with industry input and investor input, try to define a limited number of KPIs by sector, and trying to use the current materiality definitions that the SEC uses. It is trying to get industries to voluntarily adopt this sort of disclosure. Too early to tell how successful they'll be, but their watchword is materiality. The second major issue is a global one, which is the Financial Stability Board. Mark Carney, the chair of the Bank of England, has charged a special commission headed by some heavyweights, Mike Bloomberg and former SEC Chair Mary Shapiro, to try to come up with universally applicable environmental disclosures, which would be integrated. And they have continuously said that they would come up with those measures by the end of this year, 2016, and they would recommend them to various listing agencies, stock exchanges around the world, and as well as some regulators, and they would expect some material adoption of them within the next couple of years. Now, there are already stock exchanges, notably the Johannesburg Exchange in South Africa and the Bovespa in Brazil, which require some level of integrated reporting. So they are not trying to reinvent the wheel. They're not trying to have a stakeholder-driven sustainability disclosure regime, but they're trying to come up with metrics which would be material for investors. And I think those two, SASB here in the United States and the FSB effort internationally, will result in a coalescing around materiality as a standard for these sort of disclosures. By the way, that will not necessarily please a lot of the other stakeholder groups, which is an interesting phenomenon. So investors who think this is material may get what we want, but the coalition that's been asking for it may have some fractures in the future. The third thing that's happening that's actually I find quite interesting is the AICPA has a draft document out on sustainability attestation. And it is in draft, and they have asked for comments. And it's quite a technical piece of work, I would say. But the fact that the AICPA has devoted so much time and effort to creating this says that they are seeing at least the beginnings of a market for attestation around these issues. Now, that same CFA survey that I mentioned, that three-quarters of CFAs around the world want some sort of ESG reporting, they asked an interesting question, which is, should it be attested to? Mm. And how much are you willing to pay for it? Which is, you know, a key issue, because we investors are cheap. We want it all, and we don't want to pay for it. And what they got was a third said they just didn't know. A third said attestation should be at the level of a major audit firm. And a third said it could be somewhat less than that. And they said that the cost of it, there were a lot of different ranges, but the 50% of the people wanted some level of attestation said it should only cost, you know, between 10 and 25% of what a financial audit costs. So those are the big picture of where we are, the changes that are coming, which are SASB and FSB, and perhaps a further down the road change, which is the potential for real attestation as the AICPA has put out their disclosure draft.
Well, that's really interesting. Some of the interesting things to me in part are a lot of what you talked about was actually not only North American centric, but US centric, which, you know, traditionally I would think that these sorts of ESG measures would be much more European as one example, or even other parts of the country. And the whole idea that it's one very good way to figure out whether the performance measure being reported is valuable is whether people want it to be a reliable measure or not, and that's where your attestation comes in. So thanks for talking about that. But as you said, not everyone has that view that you sort of articulated there. Brian, can you give a little bit of a counterpoint to this position about how desirable it is to integrate environmental, social, and governance measures, not as a separate report, but into the financial reports?
Well, let me start with John's last point, which is the attestation point. I happened to write the release in 1997, which the then Big Six recommended that MD&A, that there would be attestation. The SEC put out a concept release, say I wrote it, and it did not go over well. It's hard to audit MD&A when it has forward-looking information, and I think the sustainability, by its very nature, is forward-looking. So I think it would be a challenge. I frankly don't know how it would happen. But let me go to the other two points about the cross-section of sustainability with the financial statements and with disclosure. I'd like to think that we have two requirements. One, MD&A, which takes into account all kinds of future developments and contingencies and known uncertainties. And I would put to you that a lot of these sustainability issues are known uncertainties. We also have ASC 450, our old FAS 5, you know, and that model works pretty well. And it's got its own shortcomings, not that we couldn't fix it up, but the notion is that it's got to be probable and it's got to be estimable. And I think a lot of the sustainability challenges are how estimable they are. Now, I do know, I have clients that have actuaries that sit down and calculate some of this stuff, especially if their industries are greatly affected by some of these environmental issues. But, you know, it's already the law that if there are environmental risks or other risks that are material. So I agree with John that it really comes down to a materiality analysis. And so I think that the rules are there. I would find it curious if there was any further development by FASB to try and fold in something into a line item and on a financial statement, on a GAAP financial statement that reflects it. But I don't think that's what John was pushing for. I think it was really more disclosure, if I understood him correctly. And I think the disclosure mechanisms are there. So I think there's some danger in the attestation. And I think, like some things, there's just sort of politics. But again, go back to when I was a director, Y2K, I had to attend Senate hearings. Why we didn't have to have separate line item disclosure for Y2K. And I said, we don't need them, Senator. We have MD&A. It already requires this. But Congress insisted, for political reasons, we put out legal bulletins. So it's always something. One year it's this, the next year it's that.
I think this is a little different. No one's asking for. I won't say no one, but I don't think line disclosures were necessary. I agree. But there's a sensitivity to the issues, particularly as you say, as. I think there's a certain sensitivity in ever shorter in the short-term trading markets that we have. It's what's material, and you didn't say to whom. It's to a reasonable investor, and the problem, as I said, is investors aren't monolithic, so. Is climate change material to a high-frequency trader? Probably not. Is it material to an index fund that's going to be a universal owner forever? Yes. And so there's a sensitivity there. And I would not compare this to Y2K, which was a come and go. I might compare this more to cybersecurity.
Sure.
There has been an emphasis by the SEC on what sort of disclosures you have to make, and to be fair, it's actually perhaps the most particularized disclosure that is done by companies, and so I do hold out a fair amount of optimism around this materiality by industry sector approach, because I would hope, being a fundamentally optimistic person, that we would follow the route in disclosure that cybersecurity disclosures have taken, as opposed to the sort of generic risk disclosure that we've all seen far too often. And I do, by the way, Mark, I agree with you. In general, Europe and Asia are way ahead of the U.S. on caring about these issues. Many companies there do have some form of integrated reporting, and obviously, different accounting standards as well, but that's a different issue. And so I think that the reason that I was concentrated on the North American and the United States-centric events is because I do think it's going to be a little different here, and it's going to be more narrowly sculpted to get around the materiality. There's much more of a shareholder bottom line approach here than the stakeholder approach that takes place elsewhere in the world.
Very, very helpful. And it is always fun to think about, what fundamental changes to our reporting models could occur. But I want to shift a little bit back to what's happening today in the area of non-GAAP performance measures. And let's just think a little bit. Christine, let's turn to you and let's talk about what's happening today in terms of comment letters that are being released or that are likely to be released in the near term. What sorts of things are catching SEC staff eyes, other regulators' eyes that result in these types of letters?
Well, we are seeing a ton of non-GAAP measure comment letters coming out of the Division of Corporation Finance, and a lot of those are starting to get posted to the EDGAR system. There's a delay, obviously, in when a company receives a comment letter and clears it, and then it gets posted on the EDGAR system. It's a minimum of 20 days after the comment letter is cleared that it gets posted publicly. But many, many of our clients have received these letters, and the vast majority of letters here today deal with prominence issues. So is the non-GAAP measure less prominent than GAAP? And disclosure-related issues. So is the reconciliation there? Is the reconciliation correct? Do they have the appropriate disclosure about why it's useful and the purpose that it's used for, how it's calculated, how it's defined? So that bucket is what I call prominence and disclosure-related. What you're also seeing, and more so in the last couple weeks, last month, is comments that are focusing on the nature of the adjustments. And so right after the CD&Is, you saw some of that. You saw lots of comments on adjusted revenue metrics, which the guidance prohibits in certain cases companies from using adjusted revenue if it's considered what they describe as an individually tailored accounting principles. We also saw a lot of comments asking about how the income tax provision was calculated or recalculated, I should say, once the non-GAAP measure number was different. So your effective tax rate could be very different since you maybe had a loss before and you now have income. And I'm also seeing comments they're asking questions about restructuring charges, or is that an appropriate adjustment, or impairments, because in the case of restructuring charges, is that considered normal and recurring? Is that a cash operating expense for the types of restructuring charges that are in fact cash? So more migration to actually questioning the underlying appropriateness of the calculation of a particular non-GAAP measure. And I know, Brian, you and I were talking about this over lunch, too, and Gibson Dunn had an analysis of some comment letters that were recently issued as part of the non-GAAP measures, and I think it fairly backed up what I said, but certainly keep me honest where I went astray.
Yeah, absolutely. You touched the high points. I think one maybe false narrative that's going in, Christine, is I've seen some accounting firms, not yours, put out words that because some of the comment letters challenge some restructuring charge for litigation, particularly, a litigation expense is being unusual, that they challenged that, and what the accounting firm said was, oh, now you can't back out litigation expenses. That's not right. What they were really doing in that letter was they called it non-recurring.
Right.
Okay? So that was not a message that you can't adjust for litigation. It's just that don't call it non-recurring because you have litigation expense routinely. The other thing to mention, sort of winding up, I know we're cutting short on time here, Mark, is the enforcement division at the SEC has ginned itself up of late on non-GAAP. There was a non-GAAP case prior to Reg G that involved the Trump hotels about, you know, backing out one-time losses but not backing out one-time gains. That was an example that John gave at the outset here. But there really hasn't been much. There's a recent case involving a REIT, but there are a couple dozen cases. Most people out there don't know this right now, but a lot of law firms know and accounting firms know that the Philadelphia office of the SEC is issuing a series of investigations into non-GAAP. Now, I can say in the limited time that we have without getting into, you know, client privilege or anything like that or confidentiality, that the focus is primarily on prominence, interestingly, not on what you would think, like the Trump hotel situation where somebody was using a GAAP term like operating in cash flow, right? Anyway, is this cash flow from operations or is this operating cash flow? Are they the same? I find myself asking that of clients who are like, oh no, it's different. I'm like, well, that could be misleading. You need to say this is not cash flow from operations. You know, I could understand that, you know, if somebody did that. But this is like you led with the non-GAAP number and then you followed it with the GAAP number. And please, you know, in light of these the guidance, tell us why you didn't violate the law. And, oh, by the way, tell us every other time you violated the law on Reg G, which is unheard of for lots of reasons. As a lawyer, I'm appalled, okay, number one. But number two is there's no requirement. There never was a requirement that you lead with the GAAP. It was only interpretation of a rule that changed. One could question whether the SEC needed to engage in rulemaking to put out what it did in May. But we'll humor that. Being a former director, I took some flexibility at some time, so we'll honor that. But still, you can't unleash the enforcement division off of May interpretations and apply it retroactively.
So nothing controversial here at all?
No, of course not. No, so there's a little moment of passion at
the end. No, if that didn't come through, I'm not sure what. Well, thank you, all of you, Brian, Christine, and John, for this discussion. We are coming to the end of our discussion. I know these have been useful insights, and I think there are a variety of audiences out there, including students, that can probably play this more than once. So I hope you as the audience have found it to be informative. The audio of today's broadcast will be available soon in a virtual museum and archive, both under programs and in the Deloitte Fireside Chats section, and edited transcript to be added later. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Deloitte LLP for their assistance in making today's broadcast possible, and for their generous sponsorship over the years for this even dozen series of quality programs.